So today's lecture is one of my favorite lectures. I think this is just an incredible accomplishment of science. It has kind of deep, very deep practical implications, very deep conceptual implications. It's pretty much you just check all the boxes. So what we'll do is we'll start by just discussing mixed state entanglement. If I have a mixed state, how do I tell if it's entangled? What do we know about that? And then clarify the open problem for really coming up with a complete solution if there is one. And then we'll discuss non-locality via bell type theorems. What I like to do to introduce that is really describe it first in terms of what's called the CHSH game. And it really clarifies how you're doing something you can't otherwise do. And then we'll go through the mathematical and experimental discussion, which is a little more difficult to grasp on a first go through, but I'm sure you'll be fine. Okay, so we know that for a pure bipartite state, we say psi is entangled if and only if the trace over B of psi psi, which is of course equal to the trace over A is a mixed state, is not pure. So we can just define this to be rho B, and then we can define this to be rho A. And then the degree of entanglement again, assuming we have a pure bipartite state, is characterized or can be characterized, is usefully characterized by the entropy S rho A equal to minus the trace of rho A log rho A. Okay, so that's pretty clean. We understand it, it's good. Now we get to the more practical situation of your best friend is an experimentalist and she built a device that creates entangled states. Of course, like any device, that state is not perfect, it's not ideal, it's not going to be pure. In practice, quantum states are never pure. We can get as close to purity as we hope, as we'd like, but we can never achieve it exactly. And you want to know, well, how can I characterize how entangled that system is? I can't use these tricks because, or these methods, because I know just from the get-go that I'm not going to have a pure state to start. So then we address the question of what are the criteria for mixed state entanglement? And this has a really neat connection to the theory of completely positive maps. So this problem is not completely solved. Is open in general. So what we know so far is that we can use what's called the positive partial transpose test. Maybe I should call it the negative partial transpose test. Well, it doesn't matter, just the name. Positive partial transpose test. Or the PPT test. So here the idea is we have some mixed state row of system AB. So that means it's an element of the density operators of HA tensor HB. And then we assume we have countable bases. We have countable bases because each Hilbert space is separable. We know that the orthonormal bases are countable. So we have countable bases, and we'll just give them names. We have some pair of countable orthonormal bases for Hilbert space A. Let me call it L and BK. For HA and HB respectively. I don't know why I always change notation. Okay, whatever. All right, so then, and then we can talk about a matrix representation. So now once we have a basis, we can look at a matrix representation of the operator. Matrix representation of row AB. So we have the operator row AB is represented as a matrix. And that matrix is going to be using our standard convention for composite systems. And we construct the matrix. Let me just drop the AB subscript. So we're going to have a matrix of the form row 1, 1, row 1, 2, row 1, M, row 2, 1, row M, 1. Row M, M. So here I've assumed that the dimension of H A is equal to M. So I'm assuming it's finite for ease of notation, I guess, or just for illustration. No, keep it finite. It's safer ground. And then the notation row 1, 1 is an n by n matrix. Okay, this is the usual way we do composite systems. So the rightmost index varies most rapidly. Is the rightmost index varying most rapidly? Is it? Well, if row 1, 1 is an n by n matrix, and I wrote this out explicitly, I would have the indices of the first matrix be, from B. Okay, perfect, yeah. So the B index is going most rapidly, which is what we want. So now that's the point. So this, in fact, I'm just going to change this notation just to emphasize this because it's not really clear otherwise. So now we introduce what's called the partial transpose. So what's the partial transpose mean? Well, you know what the transpose is. The transpose of a matrix takes the upper diagonal, the upper right-hand triangle, moves it to the lower, swaps with the lower left-hand triangle. But now what we're going to do is we're only going to transpose one of the systems, Okay, so what that looks like, it's equal to the identity operation on system A. Tensor producted with the map on system B is the transpose operator. Okay, so this is odd in multiple ways. First of all, the transpose map is not a physical map. Second of all, it's a basis-dependent operation, also very strange, but this is going to work. So we have this transpose operation, which depends on what basis we're working in. Well, it's expressed at least in terms of the basis. And this is a super operator, an operator acting on operators, that takes as input our density matrix on AB, which when expressed as a matrix, let's call it the output of that is going to be sigma. Then what we have is that what sigma looks like is going to be rho 1 1 transpose, rho 1 2 transpose, rho 1 m transpose, and you see the pattern, rho 2 1 transpose, rho m1 transpose, rho mm transpose. So what we're transposing here, this is A, and this is B. So we're transposing the B system only, which means this matrix is not transposed with this matrix, which would happen if we're doing transpose on A, but each matrix internally, which is the B matrix, is getting transposed. So now, if sigma is a positive operator, is a positive matrix, it won't say is positive, then we say sigma is PPT, or then rho is PPT. What that means is, because sigma is the partial transpose of rho, so now we're saying that if rho, when the partial transpose operation is applied, produces a positive output, positive state, then we say that rho is PPT. It's a state that is positive under partial transpose. So now here's the result. PPT, a matrix having positive partial transpose, is a necessary condition for separability. So, when stated otherwise, what this means is that separability implies positive partial transpose. And we can also, another equivalent way of saying this is that negative partial transpose implies entanglement. So this is an equivalent statement. So equivalently, okay, so that's what we know. So why does this work? Okay, so this will really make it clear. So recall, first of all, let's recall the definition of separability. Rho is separable if and only if, so this is the definition, if and only if it admits a decomposition of the form rho where PI is some probability distribution. And sigma AI and sigma BI are density operators for A and B, Hilbert spaces HA and HB. And it doesn't matter what these sets are, as long as they exist. Now, there was a really good question asked to me after class last lecture. And it was asking about, well, look, if I have, let me make the statement and then explain what I'm talking about. Separable, first of all, so separable would take to mean unentangled. These are equivalent words. So note that separability is relative to some factorization of the Hilbert space, is only defined or meaningful, or is always is in relation to some particular decomposition of the Hilbert space, or factorization, let me call it, factorization Okay, so what I mean is, for example, if H is equal to C20, I can think of C20 mathematically, I can think of this as C4 times C5, or I can think of it mathematically as C10 times C2. So this is a mathematical fact, not a physical fact. So physically, this space is going to be made up of systems that have some well-defined Hilbert space, which is defined by the physics of the problem. So this is just a mathematical concept in general. So when we talk about it being entangled or not, we're only speaking in relation to some specification of the factorization of the Hilbert space. You can't talk about a state rho AB in C20 being entangled without telling me what are the factor spaces you're talking about. So that's first should be clear. And similarly, in this case, this can be equal to C2, C2, tensor C5. So in other words, I have two qubits and one five-level system, maybe the angular momentum of my atom, my two-electron atom or something like that. The state can be entangled between the four-dimensional Hilbert space and the five-dimensional Hilbert space. Or we can talk about it being entangled between these two factor spaces, but not entangled to C5. So you always have to tell me what is the partitioning or the factorization we're talking about. So that's always in the background. Okay, so that maybe wasn't clear if this is the first time you're talking about it. But there's always a background assumption about factorization, which I built in right here when I talk about HA and HB. Okay, so that was, sorry, that was a bit of a digression. Let me just end the digression here. Okay, now continuing on the main claim, rho is separable if it admits a decomposition of this form or it's unentangled. So why does this work? Okay, now also I want you to recall from a few lectures ago, recall that dynamical transformations which we derived from our ideal axioms . So remember the two methods. We had convex mixtures of transformations, and we had partial tracing out when you had a unitary and an extended Hilbert space and you ignored part of the system. We obtained effective maps, which were this Krauss form, and we saw by Krauss's theorem that a map admits a Krauss operator decomposition if and only if it's completely positive. So the maps we obtained from physical considerations were completely positive. And I'll get to your question in 1 second. If you were able to if you're just mathematically writing down what general maps should look like, you might say, well, I don't care about complete positivity. I might just want it to be positive. And it turns out that that's not strong enough because that can generate unphysical situations. So I'll review that now, but first let me take this question.
So over there, going way back. When you say that sigma is positive, do you mean that every element is positive or that the transpose is positive?
So here, as usual, positive means that sigma as an operator applied to the matrix elements between the expectation value for any quantum state in the Hilbert space leads to a non-negative. So first of all, positive means non-negative. And second of all, it also means it's with respect to its action on Hilbert space states. Now, for certain classes of operators that are diagonalizable, it means it has non-negative eigenvalues. Okay?
So it doesn't even need to be necessarily positive. It can be zero as well.
Yeah. In fact, if you have a pure state, if sigma is a pure state, then it will have one eigenvalue equal to one, and the rest of its eigenvalues are zero, and its matrix elements will be zero for some view. If sigma is sigma is a pure state, say it's equal to 0, 0, and this is a density operator on C2, then the expectation value of sigma with respect to the orthogonal state is equal to 0. This is obviously a canonical example of a density operator, which is a non-negative operator, and we say non-negative because we mean 0 here. It's just, I think there's just, the terminology is unfortunately misleading. It's not just me, this is the standard. I don't know if it's physicists or mathematicians that did this to us, but positive means non-negative. Okay, so what did completely positive mean? Well, so what that meant was that complete positivity is the requirement for some map lambda. We require that lambda tensor the identity operation acting on rho, which produces sigma, sigma is positive for any rho, where what we do is we've appended some extra Hilbert space, and we're doing nothing to that Hilbert space. But we're asking that when lambda tensor identity act on states in that bigger Hilbert space, where it's acting on part of the state, the overall state of the full system remains positive, which is a physically natural constraint. Otherwise, you could generate a density operator is in a bigger Hilbert space that has negative, that have negative eigenvalues, which would be unphysical because that would lead to probabilities that are negative, which is also unphysical. So let me show that graphically. So if we say lambda is, we'll just call it CP, let's call it CPTP, where we'll just throw, normalization is bookkeeping, so it's not material. If and only if, for any HB, such that we have H equals HA HB, and let me change this to on HA. So our system of interest is HA. We say lambda is a CPTP map on the states in HA. If for every Hilbert space I add into the story, and for every row, which is a density operator on HB, we have that lambda tensor identity on B acting on row produces an output sigma such that sigma is a density operator on HB, HAB, which is HA tensor HB. Sorry, I promised you a graphical illustration and instead I gave you a mathematical definition. So let's just show what that looks like. HAB, HA, the joint state is rho. We have our map lambda and we get some output sigma. So here, this is do nothing here. Okay, and you see how this is physically relevant, right? Like you have to have this to so that sigma produces valid probabilities when you do a measurement on it. And of course, this came out naturally from the way we constructed completely positive maps. It's just that if you just kind of had to guess what the set of allowed transformations, generalized noisy transformations on a system was, you would guess that it had to be positive, and you wouldn't think that this would be a you wouldn't think that this would add any extra constraint on the set of objects lambda. So the point now is that this is a non-trivial constraint. So CP versus P, positive maps, is a non-trivial constraint. What does that mean? It means that there exist maps lambda that are positive but not completely positive. So what does that mean? That means there exist maps such that if I just look at the action of this map on some input state and some output state, it looks like it works and produces a positive output. But when I dilate the system, not dilate, but when I append this trivial system, the map no longer produces positive density operators as output. So an example is the transpose map. So what's the transpose map? So let T be a map that takes density operators on HA to density operators on HA. So what that means is that given any, for clarity, let me now add my ABs in. Let's call tau a density operator on HA. For any tau, which is a density operator on HA, the transpose map acting on tau produces an output sigma A, which is a density operator on HA. So that means that the transpose map is positive because it takes positive operators to positive operators. But T is not completely positive because there exist operators rho, which are density operators on HA tensor HB, such that T tensor identity acting on rho produces as output sigma, where sigma is not a density operator on HA tensor HB. Now, what can you tell me? What condition does rho have to satisfy to produce one of these counterexample cases, one of these unphysical cases?
It's got to be entangled.
It has to be entangled, right? Because, so this shows that, but rho must be entangled if sigma is not in this class. How do you see that? Insert the definition of a separable or an unentangled state. We assume, if we assume that rho AB is unentangled, then it admits a decomposition of this form. Okay, so let's do that. Let's do it over here. So here the proof. We do T tensor identity acting on the sum over I PI sigma AI tensor sigma BI. Our quantum maps are linear maps, so that means this is equal to a sum over I PI T acting on sigma AI, he's a super operator, tensor identity acting on sigma BI. Identity acting on sigma BI does nothing. T acting on sigma AI produces, T is positive. So when it acts on sigma AI, it produces a positive operator as output. What did I call the output of T over there? What notation did I use? I called sigma?
Yep.
All right. Let's call it tau AI. Tensor sigma BI. Where tau AI is a density operator on HA. So this is a density operator on HA tensor HB. Because it's a convex combination of valid states of the two systems. So if the state is unentangled, we will never see this partial transpose map produce an invalid quantum state. That's why the PPT criterion gives a one-sided test. It can detect entangled states by producing negative eigenvalues. But is it also a complete test? Does every entangled state, when the transpose map is applied, produce an invalid output? And the answer to that is no. So the PPT criterion is not a complete test. Well, let me say it differently. Is not a complete test. Because there exists entangled, non-separable, which is another way of saying entangled, input states to T tensor identity partial transpose map that do not produce NPT states. Does not produce non-positive what does non-positive mean? Okay, you know what? I'm not going to stress about obtuse terminology. I'm just going to invalid quantum states. On HA tensor HB. So it can detect some, but not all entanglement. And that's why it's an open problem. We don't have a necessary and sufficient condition that any entangled state will satisfy. We don't have a necessary and sufficient criterion. We only have a partial criterion. And one more fact. Interestingly, however, for H equal to C2 tensor C2 or equal to C2 tensor C3 or equal to C2 tensor L2R, the PP test is necessary and sufficient. The PPT criterion is necessary and sufficient. Okay, so we have a complete solution for very small dimensional systems coupled to these other three, for two-level systems coupled in these three cases, we have a complete answer. But in general, we don't have a complete answer. And this is a big open problem. So if you solve this problem, you become famous. Yeah?
Over here, you're saying that the transpose cross product with I on acting on rho gives you sigma, which isn't in the domain of the...
Oh, sorry, D doesn't mean domain. It means density operators.
Density operators.
That's important, yeah.
Of the Hilbert space given. But then in the proof over here, it seems like you're acting on the same thing, and then you are saying it is.
Oh, because this is a special case. I assumed here the input state was unentangled.
Okay.
So this is the proof that only entangled states can be NPT.
Sigmas be host?
Pardon me?
Shouldn't these sigmas be host?
Sigmas be, what's the word you used?
Oh,
row. Well, I'm just defining any notation I want. What do you mean?
I mean,
you want me to be consistent? For something written way over there? I'm just joking. Go on. What? Hey, don't. I'm just joking. What is it? This row here?
I mean, you're assuming that the rho is not entangled, so...
Well, rho is just a symbol for any input state. So this is like the class of input states.
Yeah, but if you're proving that, that's in contradiction with your theorem step, but never mind.
I think I ran out of symbols is what's going on here. Am I understanding you correctly? Does someone else want to step in? Maybe, I don't know if I'm missing something. Or if this is, I mean, am I being notationally inconsistent?
Tau and sigma, I think that's the problem.
All right, so, well, here, I mean, the point is, when I do this, I'm trying to define things locally, right? So tau here is an element of the Hilbert space, DHA, and sigma A here is an element of, so I'm trying to carry around, I kind of ran out of symbols, so I'm just carrying stuff around. So here, we have this definition of rho, and what am I saying here? So here I'm saying, if I have some rho and I do this, I can get, so what I mean here is, there exists rho in DHA tensor DHB such that, okay? And here I'm saying that the row would, that exists such that this is true must be entangled if we're going to get that outcome. And then over here I'm saying, here we have row AB, and I've given, so this is some row AB, which is defined to be, to admit this decomp, are we good?
Yeah, you didn't solve that step up there. It's okay.
Oh, you're okay, okay, good. And then the problem was that then I used my sigmas there and, yeah. All right. Any questions, other questions? Yeah.
I'm a little confused about the definition of entanglement. If you have like three qubits, A, B, and C, then does it make sense to ask only about the entanglement between A and B, or only between A and B, C?
There. Okay, so basically, as you can imagine, there's, no, maybe not as you can imagine, but people look at all kinds of scenarios. So there's like some notion of many body entanglement, how do you characterize that? And this is the kind of the simplest and most elementary case in a huge family of settings you can consider. And so you can ask about, if I have a tripartite system, what can I say about the entanglement between all the different partitions? Because I have now three choose two ways to talk about partitions of that Hilbert space. And it, basically, this is a fairly clean case for which we don't even have an answer. And then, of course, then you can just, it gets really complicated really fast because there's so many different scenarios to consider. And, you know, people study that. You know, a kind of a naive way to define tripartite entanglement is to look at some function of all the bipartite entanglements you can construct on that space. That's one way to do it. And yeah, I'm not an expert in the area.
So this is all bipartite?
Yeah, this is the bipartite case. But it's very similar to correlation. So, you know, when you introduce the concept of classical correlation between two random variables, that's like a fundamental building block of conceptual building block. What does it mean for these random variables to be entangled, to be correlated? And then now you can say, well, I have more than two random variables. How do I talk about correlations there? And then there's a huge number of ways you can think about doing that. And basically, each little special way you go ends up being some very, very specialized problem, which may or may not be relevant to other ways of thinking about it. And so the kind of the degree of relevance of these questions quickly kind of fades to obscurity is the problem. So don't let your supervisor make you work on a problem like that. All right. So I think we have enough time to actually do Bell's theorem today. But please let me take any more questions about this. So here, this is a very mathematical discussion of what does it mean for something to be entangled. Now let's talk about what's at stake physically for when you have entanglement. Like when you're trying to decide if you have entanglement, what's it good for? Okay. So as promised, I'll introduce this by talking about what's called the CHSH test, which I haven't done in 2 years, and I'm doing it off the top of my head. So I apologize in advance. So basically, talk about the physical significance of entanglement. So we're going to talk about the CHSH game. So the CHSH game is really neat. So basically, you imagine a game show. Okay, so you're in a game show, and the game show works like this. There's two electromagnetically shielded boxes. So imagine you have to go through airport security, okay? So you're going through airport security, you have to take off your belt, your shoes, put all your devices in a tray, and then they put you into one of these boxes. And so here you have Alice, And then over here you have Bob. And we'll just call them A and B. And the point is that there can be no communication between them. But they both can have a little piece of paper. And they can collaborate in advance to write anything they want on that piece of paper. Okay, and then, so the idea is to prevent them from communicating in any way. And so what we're gonna look at is their ability to demonstrate correlations with no causal explanation. So here's the game show. The game show is that they both are asked questions by the game show host. And those questions are of the form 0 and 1. I should be much more creative, I agree. No, their questions are something like, I think this is actually in your notes. I think this is in your notes. They're asked questions, what do you want the questions to be? It can be anything you want, but their answers are also gonna be, their answers are gonna be binary. So yes, no answers. Okay, yes, no answers. So they're both asked question pairs. So Alice and Bob both ask the same questions simultaneously. And now the point is, it doesn't even matter what the questions are. What matters is what their answers are. So what we want them to do is we want them to agree as much as possible, depending on the type of question. So so the questions, let me just see if I have some kind of notation here. All right, so the questions can be 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. I should really have a good example for this. But anyways, they're asked these questions. And now the point is their goal is for, they want their answers to agree, which are yes, no. Yes, no answers, which we'll call I don't call them anything here. Their answers, which are yes, no, so these are binary answers, should agree. Doesn't matter what the answers are, it just matters whether they agree or not. They should agree for question pairs. Zero, zero. Zero, one, and 1, 0. But if they get the question pair 1, 1, their answer should disagree. Okay? So, how often can they win this game? On average, statistically. Obviously, if they're really fluky, they might be able to be perfect for a very large number of runs. But on statistical average, how often will they win?
Three-fourths.
I'm sorry?
Three-fourths.
Correct. 75% of the time is the optimal strategy. Using an optimal strategy, of which there are several, they can win 75% of the time of the games. What is an example of an optimal strategy? I'm sorry? Who said that? Oh.
They plan to always agree.
Always agree. Exactly. Just always agree. Wait, they can't always agree. What does agreement mean?
They can always say write yes. On the paper or say one every time.
Yeah, always say one every time. Always say yes or always say no. And then, which is something I didn't say, which is that these questions are assumed to be uniformly random. So there's no bias in which questions you're asked. Then if these questions are uniformly random, 3/4 of the time, they will get the condition that is met by agreeing. And so they always agree to say one or always agree to say zero or yes or no, always. And then whenever they're asked this, they're going to mess up and they're going to disagree when they should agree. Now, what would be a cheating strategy? Suppose that Bob sneaks his cell phone in there, and suppose Alice and Bob will sneak their cell phones in. How often could they win, and what would that strategy be? This is easy.
Time to text each other.
Yeah, they text each other. What do they say to each other?
Disagree
this time. Now, would that work? So remember, all Bob knows, Bob doesn't know what Alice was asked. He only knows I was asked a one. So he doesn't know if this is the case or if this is the case. So what does he have to tell Alice?
Question he has.
I have a one, and I'm going to say yes.
He just has to say the question he was asked. And then she can make the decision about whether they always say yes unless Bob gets a one, and then she says, well, I got a zero. Bob doesn't know that, so then she says no. And then they win 100% of the time. And notice, what are the minimal conditions that have to be met to win 100% of the time? They need one-sided communication. So we need one player be able to telegraph to the other player what question they were asked. That's sufficient. Notice that if they always say yes, then notice that suppose they want it to look like their answers are random. On their little sheet of paper, they could actually have a string of correlated zeros and ones, the same sequence. And whether that is a zero or one, their strategies either agree with a yes or agree with a no. And then Alice would do an on-the-fly adjustment. So then their answers would be random, but correlated. And then without the cheating strategy, they win 75% of the time. With the cheating strategy, they win 100% of the time. But the cheating strategy involves some kind of causal communication. And there is no other way to cheat the game, classically. So quantum mechanically, there is a way to cheat the game. So if Alice and Bob both did their PhDs in experimental quantum physics, and they built a little device which is like embedded in their skin, which can overcome the electromagnetic shielding. So notice that for Bob's cell phone to work, there has to be a hole in the electromagnetic shielding has to fail, right? Because even if he has his cell phone, even if he sneaks his cell phone in there, this signal goes out, but then it bounces off, okay? And he just cooks himself with the microwaves, all right? So there has to be, first of all, they have to sneak in the cell phone. Second of all, the electromagnetic shielding has to fail. So what can they do to cheat? Well, suppose that all Bob does and Alice does, they both sneak in a experimental apparatus that provides them with ordered sets of Bell pairs, of spin half particles. Then it turns out they can win 85% of the time. It doesn't have to be hidden. Hidden is just referring to the game scenario. Given access to ordered quantum states, ordered quantum systems, in an entangled state. And remember, what does entangled state mean? Entangled state means a preparation procedure that produced those systems, which is described by an entangled state. In an entangled state, they can win. They can win 85% of the time. So that's incredible. So this is an example of correlations with no causal explanation. There's no way for us to understand a causal mechanism to explain this. that doesn't violate special relativity. But these correlations don't violate special relativity. But there's no explanation that doesn't violate special relativity. So that's the subtlety here. So this is consistent with special relativity and general relativity. But if we try to make up a story to understand how this could possibly be via some causal mechanism, that causal mechanism violates relativity. So that's what's weird. Okay, so what's neat about this example is that, first of all, it really simplifies the problem, shows the capability, and also shows that entanglement isn't just a curiosity for debates about quantum foundations. It's actually a resource for solving problems that you can't solve, albeit this is a very contrived problem. But it turns out there are very non-contrived problems where entanglement is useful, such as quantum key distribution, which is a new way to establish privacy that's enabled by quantum entanglement and overcome some of the limitations of standard techniques. Yeah.
So how exactly would they use the entangled state to?
Sure. So basically, they would Bob has this set of quantum systems. So basically, it's a long string of spin half particles and that are ordered. And then the first time they're asked a question, Bob can do a measurement on his first quantum system. And what he does is, what measurement he performs depends on whether he was asked a one or a zero. And then Alice also does a measurement on that first system in her ordered set. And what measurement she does depends on whether she was asked a zero or a one. And then the answer they give is the outcome of that measurement. So you get plus h bar or minus h bar, plus h bar over 2, minus h bar over 2. Or you can do this with photons, and you have circular polarization versus or horizontal versus vertical polarization. The outcome of the measurement from the Born rule, well, not from the Born rule, but the Born rule is the probability of that outcome. The outcome of the individual measurement is what tells them what to answer. So that's all they need. And now we'll do the math to show exactly what they have to do so you can actually go and build it. Any other questions while I prep for writing this all out? So now you'll learn about Bell's theorem the traditional way. So first, let's explain the experimental setup, which is very similar to this. You'll see the analogy. We have a source, which now I'm kind of breaking my illustrations. So this looks like a transformation device, but it's really just a source that, here, forget that. Let's do it like this. We have a source, and the source emits quantum systems. There's a little go button on it. And what that's going to do is the quantum systems it's going to emit are two systems. So it's a bipartite system. And then it turns out that it emits one system in this direction and one system in that direction. And then over here, we have a measurement device and another measurement device. And we have little knobs to determine what we're measuring. And we have a little readout with our pointer position on it. And there's a light bulb. And this is Alice's system, and this is Bob's system. So the point is, the input to Alice is a zero or a one. That's the question she's asked. She translates that into a measurement operator, a zero or a one. So these are measurement operators. And then Bob gets asked as input a 0 or a 1, and he translates these into measurement operators on his system. So these are self-adjoint operators, say. And then as output for Bob, he has to give an answer, yes or no. And so his answer, we're going to call that variable y. Y. We're going to give y an index n. So this is how it's called, y. I won't put the n yet. Y, and that's going to depend on the measurement bk. And Alice's output is also a variable x, which depends on the question she asked, and I call that al. And now this is just the number between minus 1 and 1. Or we can restrict it just to be minus 1 or 1. Doesn't matter. So when we take it to be the discrete set, 1 or minus 1, that corresponds to the yes and no answers. We can also allow the output to be a continuous variable, and the argument goes through. Okay. And now what we're interested in is the success condition, the success criterion. Over many runs, n goes from 1 to capital N. So that's the number of questions they're asked, or the number of quantum systems of repetitions of the game. And it's equal to the number of the ordered set of their quantum systems. In the CHSH game. So in the CHSH game, we're imagining them having this collection in their pocket. But in this setting, we're imagining, you know, you press go, you do one run, you press go, so there's no one's collecting these quantum systems. So you can think of it either way. So the success criterion is that the success condition is defined as the expectation of A0, B0 plus A0, B1 plus A1, B0 plus A1, B1. Okay, so this there's a lot packed in here. So remember, 0 and 1 are the question they're asked, and A and B are the operators they assigned. The operators they've pre-assigned to those questions. And I make a typo here. This is a very important typo. This is a minus sign. Okay. So now this is a quantum expectation value of a joint measurement of the bipartite system where Alice is performing her experiment on one side and Bob is on the other side. So to relate this to quantum mechanics, to relate this to QM, you have that AL BK, what that means is the trace of some measurement operator A, tensor a measurement operator B, given some input state rho. So the measurement being performed on the state rho from the source is that Alice measures A, Bob measures B on their portions of the system. That's the quantum mechanical prediction for each of these quantities given the input state rho. What does this mean experimentally? This is something you know, but let's be crystal clear about it. Experimentally, so how do you measure this? Experimentally, what I do to measure each of these correlations, so this is theory. Experiment is that AL BK is equal to the expectation overruns N of our random variables X times Y condition on the measurement. And what's that expectation is the limit as N goes to infinity, infinite runs. We take the average of infinite runs, sum over N equals 1 to N, I hope you can see this from that angle, of what I call the variable here. I always change my notation for some reason relative to my notes. I'm going to aggravate people like this guy. Yn bk. So let me write that again for those of you over here. So what we have here is that the expectation of ALBK experimentally, experiment is equal to the limit as N goes to infinity, 1 over N, sum over N equals 1 to N of XN ALYNBK. So given the choice of measurement, they get some outcome, which is either 1 or minus 1, or some variable in the interval 1 to minus 1, and we're multiplying them together because we're looking at the correlation between the outcomes. So this is how you experimentally measure this quantity, and this is how you theoretically predict it using quantum mechanics. Now, Bell's theorem has two components to it. The first is to prove an upper bound on this experimental quantity, because this is an operational procedure. This is a procedure I perform. And so the question is, if I assume that the source is classical, and I only have classical physics available, and I assume that there's no communication between A and B, which is an assumption, then I can bound, I can upper bound S. So Bell's theorem is to prove, so Bell came up with this in, what was it, 1964, maybe? And then CHSH came up with kind of a cleaner version, which had a little less, fewer assumptions in, I think it was 1972. All right, I don't know. So we're going to look at the CHSH version because it's a cleaner argument. It actually has one less assumption than Bell, so they dropped the assumption of determinism. And so Bell's, the proof is that it's that we'll call it the CHSH inequality is that S is bounded between 2 and minus 2. Based on assumptions, Okay, so the assumption is that they can't communicate. That's basically it. The assumption is that the output of the pointer of this box is not allowed to depend on the dial setting of this box. Or it can depend on it, but it can't vary from run to run. So it can't depend on it for each run. You can preset it and forget it, but you can't change it every time. And the pointer outcome here cannot depend on the pointer of Alice from run to run, and vice versa. So this is the shielding condition. The note, clearly, if we can build this box to see what's happening with this box via some communication, then we can win 100% of the time. So what's interesting is what bounds do you achieve if you assume no communication, no causal mechanism? And if you assume no causal mechanism is available, then you get this bound. But then we'll show that if we prepare rho to be some special family of entangled states called Bell states, and if we judiciously choose what AL and BK are, which I'm missing my subscripts here, then we can show that S can be greater than 2. So with entanglement, we get this. So that's the amazing thing. So we call it a violation of local realism, because if we're going to talk about a causal mechanism, we think there's something physical. That's why it's called a mechanism. And so, and we want that mechanism to explain causal effects. And so this is seen as a violation of local realism. And so you're going to have two choices. Either you abandon the notion of realism or you abandon the notion of locality. And those are pretty much your only two choices. I don't know that we will be able to get through this whole thing. So maybe I'll say a few more things. Or maybe I should take some questions so you guys can start letting this simmer a bit. Yes?
I missed what X and Y were over there.
X and Y is the output of the device. So this is the pointer position. Pointer position. So what that means is that now Y here has no subscript. And here we added a subscript right here. So this subscript just denotes runs, okay? So in quantum mechanics, we generally describe the abstract scenario. We don't explicitly index the runs. But when we're doing an experiment, we do have to index the runs. There's got to be some questions about this. Come on, go for it. This is your chance. Say no. This is impossible. You're lying. Who cares? Something. You're just anxious to see the proof, I guess, right? You guys want to see me back this up with mathematics. All right, so there's two interesting pieces. One is showing this bound, which is actually just a simple algebraic exercise. And then the other is deriving this violation of the bound using the tools we've developed over the past 2.5 weeks. Yes?
I'm not sure I have a very good understanding of what S is supposed to represent.
So S is encoding. Remember the CHSH game. We had this kind of bizarre success condition where if they were asked 3 different possible questions, 3 of the 4 possible questions, we wanted the answers to agree. So then that corresponds to, what's a correlated variable? If you and I both answer 0 or both answer 1 repeatedly over trials, there's a positive correlation in our outcomes. If you and I consistently disagree, there's a negative correlation between our outcomes. So here what we're asking for is we're asking for a positive correlation for 3 sets of questions and a negative correlation for the 4th question.
the negative correlation for the fourth question is a success. So if you wanted to keep track of scoring, you would say, well, each time they agree for the first three questions, they get a point. And if they agree on the last question, they don't get a point because they fail. But if they disagree on the last question, they get a point. So think of we're adding up their score. And so what S is doing is it's keeping track of their score. So how many times when they were asked the pair 0, 0, did they agree? Well, every time they agree, we get a +1 here, +1 here, +1 here. And then when they want to disagree on this question pair, disagreeing means there's a minus sign. So we put a minus here to cancel this minus so that it's a positive for their score. It's a good thing. So yeah, it took me a long time to kind of understand why this minus sign was relevant. And it's because we're rewarding, the success criterion is rewarded for this being negative, and that leads to a positive, because we want S to be as big as possible, is the point, under these bizarre constraints. Not bizarre, but idiosyncratic. Yeah.
I just want to add to that, that S equals 4 is winning perfectly, right?
Yes.
In this game, whether or not you win, you're just talking about can they completely win or not. But here we're saying we're measuring like what their success was in some sense.
Yes.
And so S equals 4 is if they're perfect. And
yes, that's correct. Thank you for that. Right. So let me write that down. So S equals 4 is a perfect score. So what's interesting is that quantum mechanics does not allow you to get a perfect score. Similarly, quantum mechanics does not allow you to win 100% of the time, just 85% of the time. And one can imagine theories, physical theories, which would allow S equals 4 or 100% victory. And as far as we know, those theories don't apply to our world. And so one of the very interesting questions when we talk about kind of deriving the axioms of quantum mechanics is, what kind of principles would give us a theory which would only lead to 85% winning condition in this scenario? Can we think of that as something that informs our understanding of quantum mechanics? I mean, it's a speculative idea that researchers have looked at. I don't know that it's led to anything useful. Other questions or comments also welcome. Okay, so we'll take this up next class, and we'll go through the proof of this bound and the quantum mechanical derivation of the violation of the bound. Thanks for your attention today.